For years, evolutionary biologist Paul Ewald has been trying to storm the gates of medical science with one claim, that most killer diseases are caused by germs, not genes. Although human genome research is the hot ticket today, Ewald says that these days research is focusing on the increasingly credible theory that viruses are the true culprits behind everything from cancer to schizophrenia. Ewald is the author of Plague Time. He told Steve Paulson how viruses attack cells.
The virus actually attaches to them, invades them, and then sets up shop in those cells. But instead of producing more virus particles that are released from that cell to infect other cells, viruses will sometimes cause the cells they're in to start dividing. And that way, they're not exposing themselves to the immune system, because our immune systems are incredibly sophisticated at scouting out foreign agents like viruses, recognizing them and destroying them. But if a virus can essentially eliminate most of what's viral and just stay as genetic material inside of a cell and make those cells divide without committing suicide and without having a cap on the total number of divisions, then they are able to last for months or years or decades inside of our bodies, reproducing, and then at some point generating new virus particles that could be infecting a new contact. And so to me, the exciting thing about this idea is first, that it turns out that decade by decade, more and more cancers are accepted as being caused by infection, which is actually scary, but it's very good news.
You're saying that a few decades ago, no one thought that cancer, any kind of cancer, was caused by infections.
Depends which kinds of cancers you're talking about. But if you're talking about human cancers, when you and I were kids, I presume back in the 60s or 70s, the dogma was essentially no human cancers are caused by infection. But starting around 1980, there's been this revolution going on in which steadily, decade by decade, more and more cancers have been accepted as being caused by infection. Until now, experts agree that a little over 20% of all human cancers are caused by infection.
What are those cancers?
Well, the one that's achieved the most attention recently is cervical cancer, and that's caused by a virus for which we now have a vaccine. And so that's illustrating what good news it is to find out that infections are causing cancers, because we're quite good at making vaccines to control infections. We can't always do that, but we often can do that. And so now the two greatest success stories, I would say, in the history of interventions to combat cancer have been discoveries that cancers caused by infection and development of vaccines or other methods to reduce transmission so that now we don't have the cancers developing because we prevent them. And that's far more effective than trying to rely on anti-cancer compounds that have a lot of bad side effects. Their efficiency is not often very good. You're providing people with maybe, sometimes you can provide them with many years of life, but often it's more of a question of a few months or a year or two. They're very uncomfortable kinds of treatments. So the general rule in medicine is if you can prevent something, it's much, much better. It's the, you know, ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure and worth a ton of not very effective treatment.
Mm-hmm. It's a question of Darwinian evolution, too.
It is.
Because I suppose that if it was just genetic factors, I mean, if there were these malfunctioning genes, they would eventually get weeded out of the human population.
They do tend to get weeded out. They tend to get reintroduced. Cancer occurs later in life, so the pressure to weed them out is not as strong as it would be if they were introduced early in life, but some cancers are occurring early in life. So you have that role of evolution acting on humans, which tends to be sort of a slow role, but those effects of that selection pressure acting on humans have been responsible for generating some of these barriers to cancer that we've been talking about. But it's very important to realize that one of the most important ways in which evolution is acting is on these viruses. Because if a virus is transmitted, let's say, by sexual contact, and people are changing sexual partners, let's say, every 3 years, that virus, once it infects a given partnership, that virus essentially has to stay viable for another, few years if it's going to be successful. So it has to have ways of avoiding the immune system. And one of the best ways for the virus to avoid the immune system is to live inside of a cell, make it divide, expose very little of the virus to the immune system. So the fairly shocking outcome of all of this thinking is that even though we don't know the full scope of infectious agents that cause cancer, we can be pretty sure about how many of them are transmitted. So they're likely to be transmitted by sex and actually by kissing as well.
You're saying we get cancer from sex?
Well, indirectly. That to me is sort of the jaw-dropping conclusion.
So celibate people are not going to get cancer?
Oh, well, then? It depends which cancers you're talking about. Because not all disease organisms that are causing or suspected to cause cancer are transmitted by sex. And it's a complicated story, but disproportionate number of those organisms that are causing cancer are transmitted by sexual contact of one sort or another.
The more partners you have, the more likely you are to get cancer?
Yes. And it's true for cancers that we know about in terms of their causation, that like cervical cancer or head and neck cancer, which is caused by the same virus that causes cervical cancer, but it's transmitted by oral sex. So there are a lot of things that are, you know, a lot of bits of information of practical importance for many people that come out of this kind of research. But also for many cancers, sexual contact is a risk factor, but we don't know what is transmitted by sexual contact. We don't know why it's a risk factor. So for prostate cancer, the number of sexual partners a man has had in his life is a risk factor for developing prostate cancer. So that implicates some sort of sexually transmitted pathogen.
And you said kissing as well is
kissing.
A risk factor.
Right. So what we know is there are some viruses transmitted by kissing, including the virus that causes the disease that we refer to as the kissing disease, infectious mononucleosis, Epstein-Barr virus, that is known to be causing some cancers and is suspected in a variety of other cancers. And it looks like other pathogens that are at least candidate pathogens for causing cancer are transmitted at least in part by kissing.
How long might this take? I mean, through if the virus is first contracted through sexual transmission, are
depends.
You talking years later?
Yes.
That
yeah,
someone
generally
might
it's
get
we're
this?
Talking about years, sometimes less, but generally we're talking about years to decades. So unfortunately, for you and me, the value of this information is greatest for young people. People just before puberty or maybe just after puberty, if they know this information, then they can make decisions about their, you know, choices of partners and also their protection if they're engaging in sexual contact. That is very likely to reduce the probability of being infected with a cancer-causing virus that eventually causes problems perhaps decades later. So it's a very long-term kind of benefit, but it's something that the sooner we start talking about it, the better off we'll be.
So you're saying that somewhere down the road, we might have various vaccines for different cancers.
Exactly.
There might be a vaccine for breast cancer.
That's right. I think there will be. Breast cancer is a tricky problem because the same virus that has been found in cervical cancer is found in about 20 to 50% of breast cancers. And it looks like that virus could be playing a role. It could be just contamination of the breast with that virus, but it's a little tricky because that virus may also be more likely to infect tumors that are already developed. So it could be kind of a hitchhiker rather than an actual cause. And so this is an area of active research. There are two other viruses that have been associated with breast cancer. One is the Epstein-Barr virus that we talked about earlier that is transmitted by kissing. And then another one is called mouse mammary tumor virus, which is normally causing breast tumors in mice, and it's getting into humans. And we don't exactly know how, but it's found in about a third of the breast cancers that have been studied and not found in many of the normal tissues. So what we're probably going to find, I think, with breast cancer is a variety of different viruses are playing a role. And that makes the whole problem more difficult. It's a little more like liver cancer than it would be like cervical cancer in the sense that it's harder to identify what cause and effect is occurring if you've got several different players.
You might have to have multiple vaccines.
That's right.
Then.
That's right. But what's interesting is the same culprits tend to be turning up in more than one cancer. So if you make a vaccine like the vaccine that protects against cervical cancer, you may get fringe benefits. So clearly now everybody agrees that if you get that vaccine to protect someone against cervical cancer, they've got a lower chance of getting head and neck cancers, like cancers of the tonsils. And so we're likely to see these fringe benefits of these vaccines, which changed a lot of the discussion that we might be engaged in. If we say, well, should we encourage use of this vaccine if it turns out that the vaccine's protecting against not only cervical cancer, but tonsillar cancer, and then maybe also against breast cancer, then it means that the benefit of that vaccine is far greater than we would originally thought. So I see this as the beginning of a golden age in medicine. I think as we understand the full spectrum of infectious causation, progression of cancer, we'll be able to prevent a lot of them, maybe 50%, maybe more. Might be able to prevent almost 90% by making vaccines against what hopefully will be a fairly small number of infectious culprits. We're discovering new ones every 5 years, and so we don't know whether it's eventually going to be 5 or 10 or 15 or maybe 20 pathogens that are involved in cancer. And sometimes we'll get lucky. We'll get a pathogen we control easily with infection. Maybe sometimes we'll get a pathogen that we actually can eliminate by an anti-infective. And that seems to be the case with stomach cancer. Pretty much everybody agrees that a good portion of stomach cancer is caused by this bacterium that also causes ulcers, this Helicobacter pylori. And what's interesting about this example is if you find a person who has an early stage of stomach cancer caused by this bacterium, and you treat that person with antibiotics, you can cure that cancer. Now, 30 years ago, if somebody said, I think we could cure a cancer with an antibiotic treatment, they would have just laughed you off the stage. But now we know that that's actually true, at least for one cancer. And so my argument is, let's be scientific about this. Let's think about the possible payoffs that we can get, the possible benefits associated with broadening our view, and let's be very careful to carefully evaluate the various explanations, the various hypotheses for causes of cancer so that we don't miss some causes that would be preventable and therefore causes that could give us, if we understand them, a really great advancement in medicine.
Paul Ewald is an evolutionary biologist and the author of the book Plague Time. He spoke with Steve Paulson.